The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Teen Vogue. Our first article for today's program is titled High School Musical, The Musical, The Series, debuts Disney's first LGBTQ plus love song. This article is by Gianluca Russo and was published July 17th of 2021. In its latest episode, High School Musical, The Series, officially made queer Disney history. The episode, named The Transformation, premiered on July 16th and features Disney's first LGBTQ plus love song, a track titled In a Heartbeat, sung by Frankie Rodriguez, who plays Carlos, to Joe Serafini, who plays Seb, who recently revealed they are also dating in real life. The moment is one that makes history while highlighting the essential representation that both actors wish they were exposed to growing up. It's so exciting, and hopefully it leaves a blueprint for more opportunities to come for other queer actors out there, Frankie tells Teen Vogue. The song comes as a moment of healing for the couple who, throughout the episode, battle normal growing pains of teenage relationships. Warning, light spoilers to follow. As Carlos travels to Mexico for spring break, heavily documenting the beautiful scenery and beautiful men, he spots along the way. Seb, back home in Salt Lake City, begins to bubble over with some understandable jealousy and jealous insecurity. He begins to wonder, is Carlos in love with me for me, or only because I'm the only other queer boy at East High? In a Heartbeat is the men to heal the fan-favorite relationship in which Carlos proves simply and soothingly that Seb's worries can be laid to rest. It's super meaningful, Joe tells Teen Vogue. You can sometimes doubt it and wonder if this is all real. Is it too good to be true? I feel like all of that is happening for Seb. He adds, they are just another relationship on the show. Their main arc isn't about oppression or being that different. They have a relationship, just like Ricky, played by Joshua Bassett, and Nini, played by Olivia Rodrigo. And I think that's what's really awesome about it. The normalization of Seb and Carlos's romance sets it apart from other queer relationships on screen in which sexuality is a burden or a hurdle to overcome, rather than just another trait of one's personality. We're not trying to achieve something crazy, Frankie adds. We just want love and romance just like everybody else. The song is about acceptance between the two, but then also how they're being presented to the world. Frankie attributes much of the show's LGBTQ plus representation to showrunner Tim Federle, a former Broadway performer turned author, writer, and creator extraordinaire. Not only are we playing queer characters, but we're also on a Disney show that has an openly gay showrunner advocating to make sure that our stories are told and done in an appropriate, accurate way, which then allows for a safe space for queer actors to step on set where you know you can be 100% yourself. It's often said that you can't change the stories without changing the storytellers, and with Federle behind the scenes, setting the tone for the characters and actors who embody their every move, authentic representation becomes more than just a goal. It's a priority. Looking back, Frankie points to Will and Grace as being a turning point for his exposure to queer characters, while Joe highlights shows like Glee and Smash. Yet the charismatic pair note that throughout their adolescence, childhood programming never reflected the international whirlwinds they faced throughout their self-discovery. That makes being a part of High School Musical, The Series, a first-of-its-kind series, all of the more revolutionary and impactful. Both actors hope the episode and the entire show challenge societal norms while reminding kids at home that they are never, even in their darkest moments, alone. For the queer kids finding solace in their after-school theater programs, for those spending hours each night binge-watching YouTube compilations of Broadway beltresses singing the end of Defying Gravity from Wicked, for those who might watch High School Musical, the series, beneath their blanket once their parents have fallen asleep, for those who live in pain or constant worry, this is for them. There is life outside of your small town or wherever you are, Frankie says, and it's all just about finding your tribe of people that are going to love and support you no matter what. Okay, the next article is titled, $15 minimum wage isn't enough for workers to afford rent in any U.S. state. A full-time minimum wage worker can't afford a two-bedroom apartment in any state in the U.S. This article is by Jackie Germain and was published July 16th of 2021, and it was published as a part of Teen Vogue's 2021 Economic Security Project Fellowship. In Florida, someone working full-time would need to make $24.82 an hour to afford a two-bedroom rental. In Colorado, you'd need to make $27.50 an hour. In Washington State, you'd need to make $29.31 an hour working full-time. The wage thresholds for a two-bedroom rental in New York and Washington, D.C. are even higher, $34.03 and $33.94, respectively. The National Low Income Housing Coalition, which just released its 2021 Out of Reach report looking at housing affordability in the U.S., puts California at the top of the unaffordable list, alongside five other states that also have a wage threshold calculated to be above $30 for a two-bedroom rental. According to the report, to afford this type of apartment, California-based workers would need to work full-time at $39.03 an hour, more than double the $15 federal living wage activists have spent years fighting to implement. The fight for $15 movement, which popularized increasing the current federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $15, has been a steady engine for nearly a decade. While politicians have advocated for incremental increases at the state and local level, even Senator Joe Manchin has finally come around to an $11 an hour, the movement has been unmistakably consistent. Today's workers need a living wage, and a living wage is $15 an hour. Despite President Biden's vocal support for a $15 federal living wage during the campaign season, his administration has yet to make much headway on this, beyond raising wages for federal contractors. Even 10 years ago, the year before the Fight for $15 movement officially launched, someone with a full-time job would have needed to make a minimum of $18.46 an hour to afford a two-bedroom rental, according to the NLIHC, National Low Income Housing Coalition, their 2011 Out of Reach report. We now know that at our current federal minimum wage of $7.25, a full-time worker couldn't afford a two-bedroom anywhere in the country. And if the 2021 Out of Reach report is any indication, a $15 federal living wage isn't enough to cover this cost either. Obviously, housing costs vary from state to state, but the NLIHC's most recent national data determined that the national housing wage, which is how much a full-time employee needs to make per hour to afford a particular home, to rent a two-bedroom in the U.S. is $24.90. For a full-time worker in search of a one-bedroom rental, the national housing wage drops to $20.40. It's also worth noting here that the NLIHC's calculations around affordability align with what the federal government and most personal finance and budget experts recommend. The general rule of thumb is that an individual's housing costs should not exceed 30% of their income. In fact, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development defines someone as cost burden or rent burdened if they spend more than 30% of their income on housing alone. Since 2001, the share of all renter households that qualify as being cost burdened have hovered between 40 to 50%, according to a study by the Joint Center for Housing Studies of Harvard University. In 2019, Representative Rashida Tlaib, a Democrat from Missouri, proposed pushing the living wage fight further, according to a federal minimum wage above the $15 that some progressive lawmakers have supported. It should be $20 an hour, $18 to $20 an hour at this point, said Tlaib, according to The Hill. And Tlaib is a Democrat from Michigan. I'm not sure if I said that correctly. She's a Democrat from Michigan. People generally seem hesitant to put an actual number on a new proposed minimum wage, but Tlaib is not the only one who's making the case that $15 isn't enough for many wage workers to live on. The COVID-19 recession also threw into sharp focus just how many individuals and families are living in economically precarious conditions. Even before the pandemic, 85% of extremely low-income renters couldn't afford their rent, and 70% spent more than half of their income on housing, according to the NLIHC report. Even though experts say the U.S. economy will likely bounce back from the pandemic recession, and job growth will increase more quickly than we have experienced in other periods of economic crisis, if those jobs don't pay a living wage, they still may not be enough for people to make ends meet. The next article is titled, "The Johnson & Johnson Vaccine Pause is a Step Toward Taking Women's Health More Seriously." This article is by Cecilia Nowell and was published April 22nd of 2021. Ileana Donner Klein knew in her gut that what was happening almost immediately when her hand started to go numb in her freshman social psychology class. As a chronic migraine patient, she had been prescribed a low-dose birth control pill years earlier to alleviate some of her menstrual migraine symptoms and had been counseled that she was at a slightly higher risk of experiencing blood clots because she had migraines with aura. When her class let out, she called her mom and then hightailed it to the local emergency room. Despite telling the intake nurse her risk factors, Donner Klein said she waited in the ER for 3 hours before she gave up and went looking for a nurse. When a doctor arrived in her room, Donner Klein's hand, now swollen and blue, she said she first told her that she had slept on her arm wrong and then guessed that she might have peripheral neuropathy. Again, Donner Klein said that she thought she might have a blood clot, and she said the doctor finally conceded that he could run an ultrasound if it would make her feel better. But another hour later, when she said no one could tell her how it would be, Donner Klein decided to leave the ER and go to her neurologist's office. She said he ran a few labs but was unable to get the results right away. Donner Clyde tried to go about her weekend as usual after the swelling in her hand went down. 2 days later, when the pain in her hand started again, Donner Klein returned to her local ER where she said the doctor on duty told her that the MRI tech had just left for the night. But years of living with an invisible chronic illness had taught Donner Klein how to advocate for herself, and she said the doctor eventually agreed to run a CT scan with contrast. When the results came in 4 days after she'd first gone to the ER, they confirmed that Donner Klein had suspected. She had a blood clot in her right brachial vein. If something had happened, it could have traveled to her lung and turned into a pulmonary embolism. On Tuesday, the CDC and FDA recommended a pause in the distribution of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine out of an abundance of caution after 6 women between the ages of 8 and 48 experienced a rare type of blood clot called cerebral venous sinus thrombosis. It's not yet clear whether the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is the cause of these clots, or that any clots are specific to women. Still, the pause came after women reported an issue. Although many young women supported the decision to investigate the clots further, they also took to social media to express their frustration that they had never witnessed similar outcry over the more common but still very rare risk of blood clots associated with combination birth control. Donna Klein was one of them. Others, like Katie Miller, shared similar experiences. While the recommended pause in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine shows how seriously experts are taking vaccine safety, many felt disappointed because they felt they hadn't seen the same caution taken for the millions using birth control pills. It's worth noting that the kind of clots caused by birth control are different from the ones being investigated in relation to the vaccine. Given that they're different, the clotting can't necessarily be compared, but for some, it's not the clots that are the issue. It's the historical gaps in women's health research. For decades, women were excluded from clinical trials, and the federal government is still working to redistribute resources so that women's health is more comprehensively studied. But women's health researchers say that the state of birth control research has improved significantly since the pill was first introduced in the 1960s. And thanks to advocacy that started decades ago and pushed for women's inclusion, generally in clinical trials in the 1990s, women were equitably represented in the COVID vaccine trials. Now, as federal regulators monitor the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, advocates say it's vital that doctors listen to women who report symptoms of clots. Any woman who asks her doctor why she has polycystic ovarian syndrome has likely heard, "I don't know." Like so many other reproductive issues that go understudied, doctors don't yet know what exactly causes this condition. And given that lack of adequate research on reproductive health, Cynthia Pearson, executive director of the National Women's Health Network, thinks it makes sense that there's an untapped well of frustration that's right there ready when any worrisome thing develops in the world of women's health. We, to this day, don't know why uterine fibroids happen. We don't understand nearly as much as we need to about endometriosis. There's no test for ovarian cancer, she says. But thanks to the tireless work of advocates, the state of women's health has dramatically improved. That includes in research around blood clots and birth control. The problem in the early days was that the results, the very, very early results that showed the blood clot risk of these high-dose oral contraceptives, were dismissed. And once they were accepted by authors, they weren't shared with women, said Pearson. In the Doctor Knows Best era, women were not able to protect themselves by taking quick action when they developed warning signs of a complication because they didn't know what to look for. In 1970, the U.S. Senate convened experts to testify on the safety of the pill and women audience members, outraged that no patient had been included in the hearings, began shouting out their concerns. That was the birth of the women's health movement in the United States, said Pearson. As a result of the pill hearings, drug manufacturers lowered the estrogen levels in oral contraceptives significantly. The women's health movement returned to Congress 20 years later when Congresswomen, speaking from their own lived experiences, began questioning the gendered gaps in medical research about cancer, cardiovascular disease, and other conditions. In 1990, the National Institutes of Health opened its Office of Research on Women's Health. Shortly after, the NIH, National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, launched the Women's Health Initiative, which, alongside research into heart disease, cancer, and osteoporosis, assessed the risks of combination hormone use in postmenopausal women. Then, in 1993, Congress passed the Revitalization Act, which required the NIH to include women and minorities, previously often excluded from trials, in clinical research. Today, Health and Human Services, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the Food and Drug Administration all have offices on women's health. As a result, says Carolyn Westhoff, editor-in-chief of the journal Contraception and professor of reproductive health at Columbia University, birth control is very well studied these days. In the U.S. and Europe, every single new hormonal contraceptive must have follow-up studies to assess clot risk. These studies typically include 100,000 women, a huge number for a clinical trial, she says. Substantial research is aimed at identifying the clot risks associated with many hormonal contraceptives, but because these types of clots are so rare, research has not been able to identify big differences between the formulations. The main aims of research now are to identify women most at risk for clots and develop safer contraceptives. Susan Wood, executive director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health and a former women's health official at the FDA and HHS, says it's also worth considering that the alternative to birth control for many women, childbirth, carries much greater risk. It's certainly concerning that so many reproductive health issues remain understudied and that women's pain is largely normalized. But some may view it as progress that even the few cases of blood clots found in the early days of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine rollout were taken so seriously, including women's roles in it. When pharmaceutical companies began coronavirus vaccine trials, Pearson said her team's first instinct was to check the raw data to see if women had been fairly included. She was pleased to see that they had been. There are so many people out there who don't have the language to talk to doctors about what's going on with them, who can't put it into words, or there's language barriers or issues with insurance and other factors that play into people's ability to get access to care, said Donna Klein. We all know our bodies. We know when something is wrong. You should be able to say, I know that something's wrong. I need help. I need care. Our last article is Naomi Osaka Speaks Out, Athletes Are Human. This article is by Caitlin McNabb, published July 8th, 2021. Naomi Osaka is the latest cover star of Time and the tennis pro that penned a moving open letter to accompany her cover, one of her first public statements since withdrawing from this year's French Open due to mental health concerns. Back in May, Osaka initially announced that she would not be participating in post-match press conferences while competing in Roland Garros to protect her mental health. The decision sparked a storm of criticism by sports media and resulted in Osaka being fined $15,000 for violating the rules of media obligations set by the Grand Slams. Only a few days later, Osaka withdrew entirely from the tournament, stating that she'd be taking some time away from the court. Now Osaka is using her voice and speaking up about mental health in a more formal and straightforward way than ever before, but her sincerity is still present. In her Time op-ed, Osaka writes that she should have been prepared for what unfolded after announcing her decision to withhold from the press at the French Open, referencing the aftermath of overwhelming media security. It has become apparent to me that literally everyone either suffers from issues relating to their mental health or knows someone who does, Osaka wrote. The number of messages I received from such a vast cross-section of people confirms that. Her problem was never with the press, but rather the traditional format of the press conferences. The way I see it, the reliance and respect from the athletes to the press is reciprocal, Osaka said. However, in my opinion, and what I want to say, that is, this is just my opinion and not that of every tennis player on tour, the press conference format itself is out of date and in great need of a refresh. I believe that we can make it better, more interesting, and more enjoyable for either side. Less subject versus subject, more peer-to-peer. Osaka emphasized that she stands by her decision to exercise self-care and that her intent was never to inspire revolt, but rather look critically at the workplace professional athletes and question the workplace of professional athletes and question the status quo. Athletes are humans. Tennis is our privileged profession, and of course, there are commitments off the court that coincide, she said. But I can't imagine another profession where a consistent attendance record, I have missed one press conference in my 7 years on tour, would be so harshly scrutinized. Perhaps we should give athletes the right to take a mental break from media scrutiny on a rare occasion without being subject to strict sanctions. In any other line of work, you would be forgiven for taking a personal day here and there, so long as it's not habitual. Osaka argued in her open letter, you wouldn't have to divulge your most personal symptoms to your employer. They would likely be HR measures protecting that, at least some level of privacy. In my case, I felt under a great amount of pressure to disclose my symptoms, frankly because the press and the tournament did not believe me. I do not wish that on anyone, and hope that we can enact measures to protect athletes, especially the fragile ones. The world number two has made it clear that she hopes to be involved in the discussions about positively shifting the culture of professional tennis for its players, stating that she has numerous suggestions to offer the tennis hierarchy. Her first recommendation, however, would be to allow athletes a small number of sick days per year, in which players would be exempt from media obligations without justification or explanation of personal reasons. I feel comfortable being the spokesperson or face of athlete mental health, as it's still so new to me. I feel uncomfortable being the spokesperson or face of athlete mental health, as it's still so new to me, and I don't have all the answers, Osaka expressed. I do hope that people can relate and understand. It's okay to not be okay, and it's okay to talk about it. Osaka revealed that she's taken her time off the court to recharge and spend quality time with her friends and family, reflecting and mentally preparing for the Tokyo Olympics, which are set to commence on July 24th after being delayed 1 year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. While she's excited to play on home turf and in front of her Japanese fans, she's cautious to declare that she's taking up the mantle of mental health activism in sports. With the wave of backlash also came a wave of support. Former First Lady Michelle Obama, Meghan Markle, fellow athletes Michael Phelps, Steph Curry, and Novak Djokovic all extended their encouragement of Osaka and her act of self-advocacy. There are people who can help, and there is usually light at the end of any tunnel. Michael Phelps told me that by speaking up, I may have saved a life. If that's true, then it was all worth it. All right, well, we've come to the end of today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. This content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. You can find Teen Magazines as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.